Happy Aloha Friday, everyone. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. This morning, we hear about pushback as the government shutdown moves into its 10th day. Members of Hawaii's congressional delegation reach out to federal workers, and labor leaders speak out during this difficult time. We talk to them about flight delays and back pay. We go on a cave expedition on the Big Island to explore a puzzling find, what a pre-contact pictogram could mean. Plus, we meet two of the Rainbow Warriors' rising star, the kicker and punter of the University of Hawaii's football team. Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It is day 10 of the government shutdown, with no signs that the stalemate would end soon. Here in the island state, transportation officials say operations have not been impacted by the shutdown, unlike some control towers in mainland cities that have not had enough traffic controllers report to work. Cities like Nashville, Boston, and Philadelphia have been affected. More than 50,000 flights are scheduled for the long holiday weekend. Flight delays across Hawaii are not occurring so far, according to state transportation officials. Congresswoman Jill Takuda met with air traffic controllers yesterday here in Honolulu. We talked to her earlier this morning.
I can't actually go to any of the towers right now. It's been closed off to members of Congress. So I was very honored that I was able to sit and just talk story with some of them that are here on Oahu yesterday, about a dozen. And they're continuing to show up for work, right? They're doing their job with a high level of professionalism. They all understand the public service that they do every single day to keep us safe. But even before the shutdown, they were understaffed. And so I don't think many people realize they put in 6-day weeks, 10 hours a day in a very high stress job. And so add to that the fact that you may not be getting that paycheck. And for some of the folks that I talked to yesterday, they're trainees, so they haven't even gotten their first paycheck yet. And now that's going to be delayed. It's a high stress job that our folks in Hawaii, easily over 200 of them, do with a high degree of professionalism. But right now, just the added stress that the shutdown means that they're doing this without pay, and they really obviously want to see this come to a close soon in terms of the shutdown.
Yeah, I worry. How is their morale?
It's from before the shutdown, the morale of our air traffic controllers, any of our federal workers, honestly, has been, quite frankly, at an all-time low. When you have the immediate firing of probationary employees, right? Remember the start of the year, which was found to be illegal, but nonetheless, people lost their jobs. You had the doging and the deferred resignation program, which just last week meant there were literally thousands of people in Hawaii removed from the roles because they took those deferred resignations. And many felt very bullied into taking part in what was for some an early retirement kind of program, when many would have still, I am sure, you would have loved to serve. And so you've just seen all of these threats coming today alone. The White House saying they're going to start to substantially lay off federal workers. So that threat of losing their jobs right now, I think anyone furloughed is going to feel some concern that they could be getting their pink slips now. This is an unprecedented strategy used within a shutdown period, something we've never seen and something, quite frankly, that's illegal. But that all weighs on the minds and the hearts of our federal employees, who just feel very, I think, demoralized. They feel that they have worked, they've committed themselves to public service. They have acted with professionalism. They've carried out their job, and yet they feel a lot of disrespect coming from this administration in terms of the way they've been treated, the way they've been talked about in the news and in social media. So it's a very difficult time where they really need us to show them some aloha.
I think there is some concern that some of these layoffs could be taking place in like the Departments of Health and Human Services, right, which administer programs for needy families. And it's tough.
I think we have to remember that prior to this shutdown and the threat of substantial layoffs that this administration is now talking about, the DOGE cuts, the cuts that were already taking place, pushing people out the door with the deferred resignation program, the fact that we already had vacancies even before that has really left many of our critical agencies and departments on a shoestring staff. So you might get the Social Security check, but if you have a problem or a question, try getting someone on the phone. I often talk to seniors out there, Kupuna groups, and they will tell me that they spend hours on the phone and oftentimes they give up. And we've had a lot of different agencies having to help them try to stay on that line and get an answer. Our offices included, trying to get an answer from folks right now is very difficult given the fact that we have less people to answer the phone, less people to really assist the public if they have a problem. And now to be faced with these layoffs, those who are remaining to answer the phone calls, those are remaining to do the work of keeping people safe, landing planes, working in our national parks, just all the things that our federal workforce does, our Veterans Administration, our ag inspectors, even food inspection. Think of all the things we rely on, and they're working at less than capacity, which puts the strain and stress on those that are there to do the work of many. These are really tough times. And so the fact that the White House is threatening mass layoffs is an insult to the public and federal workforce.
When we last checked in with you, I know you were actually heading over here and you expected to be back in D.C. this week. Obviously, the House is not in session, but what are you hearing now at this juncture?
I think it's extremely disappointing, the fact that I headed back to D.C. to try to avert the shutdown and Republicans were nowhere to be found, and then they canceled votes this week. And they are canceling votes next week. And so actually, I just got off a call with our caucus and Democrats are heading back into town. We'll be back Tuesday night on the verge of when many federal workers will be missing their next paycheck. We're going to show up to work and we're going to let the country know that we're ready to end this shutdown. Republicans need to get back and start to really negotiate so we can reopen government. So I'll be heading back next week, but keep in mind, they hold the gavels. They control the White House. They control the majority in the House and the Senate. We can't hold a hearing. We can't even engage in session unless they do. But we're going to show back up next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, be in town, and they need to do the same. They need to come back too.
We know that the Republicans are blaming the Democrats for this shutdown, and there are some whose votes went over to the other side because they feared that the president would use this shutdown as threatened to trim the rolls of our federal workforce. And if they control the Senate and the executive branch, that it really leaves Democrats powerless to push back. I don't know. What do you say to that?
It's true. They control the White House. They control the House, the majority in the House and the Senate. But I think, you know, the fact that Democrats have held the line that we can reopen government and we can protect people's lives by making sure they have access to health care, you're starting to see that message stick. The fact that Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has all of a sudden realized that what we've been saying all this time is true. When her own son got his notice about his premium under the Affordable Care Act marketplace was going to double, and how he wouldn't be able to pay for his health care because we failed to act. And we're saying this is what we're talking about. We must act to protect health care for millions of Americans across this country, for tens of thousands of people right here in Hawaii, that we've got to cancel the cuts, the $1 trillion to Medicaid that are going to impact, again, millions of people across this country. And if we think about Hawaii, 460,000 people in Hawaii get their health care, and we're talking from children, keiki to kupuna, rely on Medicaid. This is going to hurt them as well, and that's what's at stake here. We can do both. This is not a matter of take it or leave it. This would never be the case. That's what Republicans are trying to shove on Americans, that this is a take-it-or-leave-it proposition with a supposedly clean CR they're putting forward. But we absolutely can reopen government and we can save healthcare. And that's what we're fighting for. And I do think that as those notices start to go out across the states of whose premiums are going to be going up, I do think we're going to start to see Republicans realize the wisdom and what we are trying to do. And that's how we have to move forward. Reopen government, but save health care. We can also save health care for millions of Americans at the same time.
And we've just learned this month of cuts to energy projects, mm-hmm. and we have a lot riding on federal transportation funds with rail and opening up next mm-hmm. week and the modernization of our airports. What are your concerns on that front?
I think everyone should be appalled and angry at the fact that when it came to the Department of Energy cuts, for example, they were blatantly political. That this was targeted at blue states and not at all based upon any kind of merit or even national interest. That's what they always use. They claim it's about national interest. You literally cut an energy program that would make sure we had energy resilience for Joint Base Pearl Harbor. So you can't say that we are focused on the Indo-Pacific and our readiness posture, and then at the same time cut a $39 million project that would have made sure that we had resilience for Joint Base Pearl Harbor. It would have created jobs locally here as well, but more importantly, made sure that when needed, if needed, called to action, that Joint Base Pearl Harbor would be prepared to act when we can't even guarantee energy stability. And anybody who's been on any one of our bases throughout the islands knows that energy instability is an absolute problem. And it just shows the hypocrisy of this administration, what they're saying they're going to do and what they actually do. This is all political vengeance, political retribution. This is no place in a functioning democracy or government. More than just being concerning, Americans need to be outraged that this is the kind of behavior that's coming from the White House.
I know if you're going to be in D.C. next week that you may miss the opening of the latest line for Skyline. You concerned about the additional funding for that?
I think we're concerned on all fronts for public funding. Yes, for the transportation program. But right now, the fact that we're shut down calls into jeopardy the ability for us to be able to pay for food benefits, SNAP benefits, WIC benefits going into November. That's a huge immediate concern that we have. From a transportation standpoint, we talked about it earlier, we're covered for essential air service funding through now November 2nd. That memo just came out. But if the shutdown goes longer, how much longer can we support these subsidies and keep these flights running, keep it cost effective going into the future? I truly appreciate the fact the state has been very willing to sit down and work with Mokulele to make sure these planes fly and that the costs are kept low. But again, these are the impacts of a prolonged government shutdown. We need to be able to pay for food that people need. We need to make sure transportation continues to run, and just the overall impact on our federal workforce. Think about the fact that we have 34,000 civilian workers through the federal government. We have over 44,000 active duty military. Just the overall impact when you consider their dependents alone. Those that will start having a hard time making ends meet, from utilities to food, we're talking easily 12 to 15% of Hawaii's population being directly impacted with the loss of income, the loss, you know, a paycheck. And that's concerning immediately for me.
All right. We certainly appreciate your time and safe travels if we don't get to connect with you before next week.
All right. Thank you.
Congressman Joe Tsukuda will head back to D.C. later this weekend, but is planning to hold a town hall meeting with constituents next week, Thursday. Look for links on our website later today. President Donald Trump has stated publicly that perhaps furloughed federal workers would not get back pay, a break with longstanding policy that has spurred outcry from different camps who argue that the law is clear on that. A 2019 law ensures back pay for federal workers. We talked to labor leader Randy Pereira yesterday. He's the head of the state AFL-CIO and HGA, the Hawaii Government Employees Association, which is the state's largest government union.
First, we're very concerned that despite the federal law, there is a threat now coming from the Office of Management and Budget that these employees would not be paid retroactively once this political stalemate is ended. And that's unconscionable and really uncalled for. They continue to provide service to all of us to keep the country moving. And it's horrible to see that they're being threatened while they're truly pawns in a different political game. But for us at the Hawaii FL-CIO, we're particularly proud of these individuals. And if nothing else at this point, we wanted to say thank you to them. We realize that they are making a huge sacrifice, that they're facing a lot of uncertainty and certainly some anxiety and even pain, perhaps. But we really appreciate what all of them are doing, whether they be TSA or air traffic controllers, USDA folks, it doesn't really matter. We are just very happy that we've got such a dedicated workforce, and we thank them for what they're doing, despite the very difficult conditions that they're operating in.
When covering a lot of the protests in the past year, I know we were just hearing that they're just puzzled by the treatment, that they're somehow the enemy within, and they're just public servants.
That's what's most, to us, unconscionable. The fact that the Republicans have vilified these employees, it's through no fault of their own. They are performing a service for our communities, and they should not be considered the enemy. Whatever political aspirations this administration has in trying to reshape government, so be it, but they shouldn't be making enemies and treating these people as if they are the problem. Their political differences with Democrats is one thing, but they shouldn't be using the employees as pawns. The employees don't deserve that, nor do our communities.
We have seen statements being made that the intention is to do away with the government union's representation for these federal workers. And I understand that the political structure is a little bit different, let's say, than private unions.
Oh, yes. Federal employees have limited rights compared to a lot of their private sector or state and local county government counterparts. And the fact that the Republicans seemed intent on protecting billionaires, yet at the same time attacking the rights of everyday middle-class working Americans is really ridiculous. And it's appalling, frankly. I have a hard time describing, frankly, just how appalling and upsetting that it is. These people are middle-class folks. They're being threatened with their union rights, their very limited rights on the job. And honestly, it's as if the federal government now is being reshaped into a kingdom rather than a democracy.
We did talk to the head of the State Transportation Department, Ed Sniffen, this week, and we asked about the operations at the airport. And he was saying at this point, nothing's been impacted. But the last go around, when the shutdown lasted, I think, more than 30 days, there were some, I believe it was TSA employees who stayed home. And yeah, the morale is probably not good, particularly with the threat that they may not get any pay when they come back to work.
No question. This has to be demoralizing. I can't even begin to consider how I would react. I think it's a testament to the folks that are on the job now to hear Director Sniffen suggest that things have gone largely without hitch at HIA and our other airports. That's great, but it is a testimony to the quality of the individuals that we have doing these public service jobs. And if not for that, I think all of us would be suffering. But at the same time, I don't believe I could blame somebody for being demoralized and thinking, I'm not going to get out of bed today, and whatever happens is going to happen. I think, sadly, that would be a human reaction. And if your back pay is being threatened, it's bad enough you're not getting a check now. But if you're being told that we don't value you even to pay you after the government reopens, I'd be upset as well.
You came out to say thank you for their service and for continuing to serve the public and show up to work during this difficult time.
That's really the underlying message here. I don't think the average American can be very frustrated with what's going on in Washington and how this is impacting the country. But if they're not feeling it themselves, they're probably not thinking about it. And local citizens may not be thinking about what kind of sacrifice these employees are making. We're really just wanting to recognize the fact that these folks are continuing to work despite not being paid, and pretty soon the military won't be paid. So for us at the Hawaii FL-CIO, it's just really a message of thanks. And certainly we're sticking with them. We're hoping that things will get better soon. Right now, there doesn't seem much optimism for compromise, but certainly we hope that changes. And we'll look to provide whatever support we can in the community. We're considering if this is going to be a prolonged outage of, in terms of the shutdown, we're looking at providing some kind of support, either through food distributions or what have you. And we're standing ready to help in any way that we can. But in the meantime, at minimum, in these first days of the shutdown, it's a really heartfelt thank you to all of them.
Yes, this could go on for another week or another month, like we saw in recent history. And the last protest I covered, it was out in front of the federal building. And I know you did have a representation from all kinds of government unions and private unions in support.
Yes. And we do represent some folks in the federal sector that are AFGE employees at the AFL-CIO. And of course, we do have a lot of concern, both public and private sector employees that we represent. And I hope I am speaking on behalf of all when I do say thank you, and certainly hang in to our federal friends, brothers and sisters, and let's hope for a resolution quickly.
It's tough when you hear rhetoric about just doing away with collective bargaining for the federal workers who are still on the job.
It's tough, but it's also, it's something that can make me particularly rather angry. These benefits are hard fought and hard won. It is only right in my mind that employees have some say on the job. And as I mentioned earlier, federal employees have limited rights relative to others that are unionized. To make them pawns in the game is bad enough, but to strip away their rights and say that we're going to hire you or fire you on a whim and you serve at our pleasure, that's yet another thing. These folks took public service jobs to serve our communities, not to serve the power brokers in Washington, and certainly not to serve the billionaires. And unfortunately, that's the path that our country is taking now, that the rights of individuals are being trampled, yet we're falling all over ourselves to make sure that the rich get more.
Are you folks planning any other demonstrations or protests in the near future?
At this point, I understand there is a protest planned by Move On and Indivisible for, I believe it's October 18th. At the present time, the Hawaii FL-CIO is not planning anything specific. We're looking more at potentially doing some kind of relief effort that would help employees if this is a prolonged shutdown. But the protests really are being organized by others.
All right, Randy Pereira, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
That was Randy Pereira, head of the Hawaii AFL-CIO, who is speaking out against the threats to withhold back pay from furloughed workers.
The first phase of a peace agreement between Israel and Hamas was announced this week. The deal is worth celebrating, but the future of the region still seems uncertain. We'll talk about the implications of this moment and what might come next, and also what we should make of President Trump's foreign policy going forward. I'm David Greene. Join Mo Lathy, Will Swaim, and me for Left, Right, and Center.
Beginning this evening at 7, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific Health. Learn more about how early detection of breast cancer through regular mammogram screenings can be life-saving at hawaiipacifichealth.org/mammogram.
A discovery of markings and ash inside a cave on the island of Hawaii has archaeologists scratching their heads. Back in 2014, scientist Tim Schuffer ventured into a Pahoa area cave on an emergency mission. The eruption of Kilauea threatened to destroy the cave before it had been fully explored. As lava flows from Kilauea's eruption were cooling above head, Schleffler found a large abstract design of parallel and intersecting lines on the cave floor. They appeared to be made from plant roots and slabs of rock. For nearly 12 years, Schleffler has researched what this finding could mean, looking into comparisons with petroglyphs on Kaho'olawe and Micronesian stick charts, which show maps of the sea that were created by Pacific Voyagers. Schleffler spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the rare find, starting with describing what he calls the pictogram in the cave.
The natural cave floor is a very smooth pohoihoi, almost clean and glassy, almost sort of glazed in effect. And this image is laid out on top of that clean surface in the back of a little arm off of the main trunk of the cave. There's four slabs of rock laid out in a line. The slabs are 20 to 30 centimeters in diameter and laid out across in a line of about a meter long. Those rocks are on top of, and also there's ash and some other things scattered around them. And then around the rocks and between and sort of under their edges a little bit, but extending another meter or two away from them, is kind of a grid or a network of both parallel lines and many smaller sort of oblique or orthogonal lines as well. And so it's, to be honest with you, when I first saw it, I immediately thought of one of these Micronesian stick charts. If anyone and if the listeners are familiar with what those are, they, you know, they look like a basket or some, a really open basket with pieces going and pieces intersecting and making kind of a geometric pattern. It is really kind of hard to describe what it is, and it's something that I've never ever seen in the 25 years I've been doing archaeology in Hawaii, and I've actually crawled around quite a few caves. So this was something that really turned me on, and something that I mean, it took me, almost 12 years to write about it and finally get it on paper in such a way that I felt like it was logical, because I didn't want to speculate too much, not really knowing anything about it. And also, so much of what you see in Hawaii, archaeology in Hawaii, is supported by a lot of oral history and mo'olelo and various historical kinds of information that helps you put together and make inferences about what might have happened or what it might have meant. And for this image, I had nothing, and I'm still searching if anybody can think of anything.
Well, one of the interesting things you did with the pictogram, as you're trying to answer, I mean, what would seem to be the fundamental question of what can this mean, is how old is this?
What you said is interesting, because really the paper came out of or stemmed from my tiptoeing around, not having a clue what it meant. And so trying to actually build a context of other sorts of instances of things, whether it's hay, the Hawaiian string figure making, or whether it was these Micronesian stick charts, or whether it's some other petroglyphs that I'd seen on Kaho'olawe, or actually I hadn't seen them, but I found in looking through lots and lots of petroglyphs, looking for something that might be anything like this thing. And I still have no idea what it means. And so the paper is really very much an academic exercise in not knowing, but trying to make something out of it nonetheless, and showing that whatever it was, whatever it did mean, whatever story it's trying to tell or message it was trying to convey or performance it was involved in, it was important and was linked to sorts of ritual production and social production and that sort of aggrandizement of individuals and social status and things that contributed to a really crazy political situation in Hawaii before contact. And so to get to your question then, how old is it and how do I know? Because it was made with organic materials, we could use radiocarbon dating. And so I took two separate samples on two different elements of the pictogram, very small, little, less than a gram chunks of some of the material, and sent them in to a lab for dating. Unfortunately, with dates, especially in this period, only a couple hundred years old in Hawaii, radiocarbon dating is not very accurate. And sometimes you get what they call multiple intercepts or estimates of an age range that can be really wildly variable. The other thing that can happen in Hawaiian archaeology generally with radiocarbon dating is if you, you know, if you take a 500-year-old ohia tree and it gets burned in your fireplace, and then some archaeologist comes along later and tries to date a piece of wood that's already that old, you can get some really crazy numbers. And, you know, there's a lot of error involved in radiocarbon dating. And what you're actually doing is you're dating when that organic matter stopped incorporating organic carbon into its being. So the event that you want to know about when it happened might not have a lot to do with the actual date of the organic matter. But, you know, we do our best. That's how what archaeologists operate. We don't have time machines. All we can do is infer and build strong inferences about what might have happened or what's most likely to have happened. You know, it's always almost a working hypothesis.
Yeah. So a lot of potential error, a lot of ways that that wasn't super conclusive. You mentioned earlier one of the routes that you looked for evidence or even just something to compare this with are the stick charts. Could you maybe talk a little bit about the significance of what those are and what they're used for?
Yeah, the similarity in the sort of graphic representation was to me the first thing I thought about when I saw this thing in the cave. But, you know, there's a lot of things that look like grids and networks of lines together. So I didn't want to jump to conclusions. But at the same time, the more I thought about it, and a lot of that lore, like in the Marshall Islands in Hawaii, was very, very secret stuff. It wasn't something you just shared with anybody. It was something that conferred power and authority on people knowing these special things. And so that's part of the argument I try to weave in the paper as well, is that no matter what, if it's conveying wave patterns or if it's conveying star lines or if it's conveying anything about navigation or maybe it's conveying something about agriculture, the point is that it's privileged information and that it did encode some sort of information in the same way that those Micronesian stick charts encoded very, very detailed information about the ocean, which, you know, Europeans at the time didn't have a clue.
Do you think you'll do further research on this pictogram, or was this study kind of the culmination of more than a decade of work and you're ready to pass off the mystery to other folks who might come across it?
Well, I hope so. And I'm hoping, in fact, one of my biggest hopes with the paper isn't that people will say, oh, you're such a genius. You did, you know, this, what a great paper. It's that someone will see this thing and say, hey, wait, I've seen something like that somewhere else. Or, hey, wait, I read about that. And or that somewhere someone will have some more information so we really can figure out more what it might have actually meant or represent or be, you know. I would love to do some more research. Like I said, we only have two radiocarbon dates, and they came up with slightly dates that are separated by at least 100 years. You know, if we had six more, maybe we could start to talk about how long it took to build this thing. You know, maybe it was built over generations. Maybe it was all in overnight. We just don't know. And it's not like I've been researching this in depth for the last 10 years. It's been an on and again, off again sort of thing. And I think about it for a while and then I go back and do some other projects and then think about it again. I presented some ideas about it at the Society for Hawaiian Archaeology meetings back in 2016 or 18, I think. And I worked a little bit with some graduate students on bits of it and trying to identify some of the organic material and things when I was with UH in the Heritage Management Program. And so it's been a source, and there's so many other things in that cave too that still should be written up and could lead to interesting other questions. There's, for example, just the number and size of the Opihi and their distribution inside this cave, which is, you know, miles long and segmented into different areas and parts. And so again, I'm hoping maybe this paper stimulates someone or something somewhere to bring up some more ideas and we'll see. For now, Pele has stopped overriding that area, but it will come again. In fact, most of the top half of the cave is probably gone now. This lower section was spared, so you can still get there to look, but no longer around. In fact, that was one of the more Indiana Jonesy kind of periods. Archaeology is definitely not Indiana Jones, right? But like the closest I've ever come was going in to see if this site, this particular site, and how extensive the lava flow had been. And literally, this was days after the flow, so it wasn't actually flowing. But we got to entrances where lava was, you know, had poured in and was solidified, and parts of the cave were, you know, it must have been 90 degrees, 100 degrees inside, and above us was probably also cooling lava. And so it was kind of one of those pretty exciting trips, which was a lot of fun. One thing I should say too, just for anybody who might be wondering, very often in Hawaiian caves and you'll find burials and ivy. And so I wanted to make really clear that everyone knew in this particular portion, for whatever reason, we didn't find a single bone. And our protocols were very strict about any kind of discoveries like that would have shut down those portions of the cave immediately to any of our poking around. On that sort of topic, more generally, caves had such an important role in Hawaiian culture generally, not just as places for burials, but places for refuge, places, maybe the most important one, the most sort of mundane, but most important in terms of their physical being is for collecting water in places, especially places out in Kau or drier areas of the island where there's really no running water. One of the most common artifacts you find in a cave in gourds that were just put in there to under water drops to catch fresh water. So they had a pretty important sort of place in Hawaiian culture. They're often used also for marking boundaries of Ahupua'a, as was Anakuakala, right on the border between two Ahupua'a.
Definitely. If there's one thing I'm taking away, it is a deeper appreciation for caves and their significance and what they can still tell us today. But thank you so much for taking the time, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, I appreciate it, too. Thank you. It's a privilege.
That was archaeologist and anthropologist Tim Schleffer talking about a mysterious pictogram that he found nearly 12 years ago in a Poa cave on the island of Hawaii. We'll have links to his published research on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, assisting local businesses in reducing energy waste. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
This month, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents Literary Events for the Keiki. Your children will join local authors Pua Akino and Keolani Nitani in fun, interactive activities, from helping to write a story on the fly to exercising their green thumbs and moving to get those wiggles out. RSVP for free at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
The number of international students arriving to the U.S. dropped almost 20% at the start of the school year as the Trump administration has cracked down on student visas. But as we reported earlier this week, the University of Hawaii system is bucking the national trend. UH reported the highest enrollment in 8 years, and international enrollment is up slightly. Today, we're taking a closer look at athletics. Two foreign students have been making waves on the UH football team, Billy Gowers and Kansei Matsuzawa. Gowers is a 29-year-old freshman punter who played professionally in the Australian Football League for a decade. And Kansei Matsuzawa learned to kick a football from watching YouTube videos when no one in Japan could teach him. Matsuzawa has excelled as the Rainbow Warriors kicker this season. He has attempted and completed more field goals than any other kicker in the league this season. HBR's Jason Ubai brings us a story on Gowers and Matsuzawa, the Rainbow Warriors' secret weapons.
It was a warm August day at Manoa, and the score was tied at 20 apiece between Stanford and UH. 3 seconds remained on the clock, enough for one last play.
A chance to walk off.
UH kicker Konsei Matsuzawa lined up for a field goal. If the kick was good, he would lead the Rainbow Warriors to victory.
Snap. Kick is up and good! And Hawaii has done it!
Unbelievable gritty performance by Mike Alejado setting up his kicker.
That was Matsuzawa's third completed field goal of the day. But he wasn't the only breakout special teams player that day. Punter Billy Gowers had 4 kicks. 3 of them pinned Stanford near their own end zone, giving the Bows good field position at key moments of the game. Both players are international students and took unconventional paths to play college football in Hawaii. Matsuzawa made national headlines not just for his performance, but because of how he got here. About 5 years ago, he was living in Japan and didn't know what to do with his life, so his dad sent him on a trip to the U.S. to discover himself. He went to an NFL game and got hooked on American football. When he returned to Japan, he worked at Morton Steakhouse to save money with the hopes of kicking in college. He sent videos of himself kicking to American colleges, and one responded, Hocking College in Ohio. After 2 seasons, UH special teams coach Thomas Sheffield recruited him. The now 26-year-old Matsuzawa says Sheffield and head coach Timmy Chang convinced him to play in Hawaii.
When they gave me offer, they showed me a huge love, and even like first day, they believed in me from the bottom. So that's the reason why I chose UH.
He focuses on improving every day.
Like 1% better, do small thing right, do my routine right. And that helps like building my confidence like every single day.
Rounding out the Rainbow Warrior special teams lineup is another non-traditional college student. Punter Billy Gowers is a 29-year-old freshman and the third oldest player in the NCAA Division I Football Bowl subdivision, the highest tier of college football. He was busy during his gap decade, playing Australian rules football professionally.
There's a lot of similarities between American football and Australian football, but there's so many differences. So the field size is a lot bigger. Yeah, it's in the shape of an oval, so it's not in a rectangle. There's got goals and behinds. So there's 4 posts and the middle ones are 6 points. The outside ones are 1. There's 18 players on each side of the field. So there's 36 guys out there at one given time. And you run roughly 10 miles every game. So it's a lot more running. There's not as many bigger, stronger guys out there. So it's a lot more of an endurance kind of skilled game. But yeah, we also don't wear any pads. So yeah, thinking about it now, it's a bit crazy that you even do that. I suppose you've got a mouth guard on, so that's great protection.
He connected with Pro Kick Australia, a group that prepares Australians to play college football in the U.S. He says he found out there are a lot of transferable skills from Aussie rules to American football.
There's a lot of physical attributes that kind of translate quite well in terms of just your hips and your leg power and your action, so your ball drop and the way you actually kick the ball. But I suppose for me personally, I think the most transferable things is a lot of the habits and the mindset and all the non-physical things, I think, that have translated from AFL, pretty much just being a professional, I guess, understanding where you're at physically, mentally, emotionally, being able to adjust your body, your mind, whatever it is, I guess, having some really really big highs and some really big lows in professional sport has definitely held me in good stead to attack this next sort of phase and the punting side of it. I suppose I think about it quite a bit, to be honest, and I try and draw reflections on my AFL career a lot for different reasons. But yeah, part of it is I feel like if I had gotten into college football or punting at a younger age, maybe 21, 22, I probably wouldn't have lasted just because I hadn't had the foundation of going through some tough times, going through some really good times. So I think having that experience and being in a team environment and being in a very competitive arduous and very physical game, I think holds me in good stead to be able to, you know, hopefully prosper.
Gowers has also become known off the field for another precision-based activity. He founded a barbershop with a friend to give haircuts and foster connections between men.
To be honest, I kind of feel like it's a form of meditation almost. Like it's one thing that I do in my life where I pretty much zone out and just get into a real flow state. So, yeah, a lot of guys want a haircut during the week but they feel bad asking, but I make sure they know that I actually really enjoy doing it. So I think that's number one for me, is I actually really enjoy the process of giving someone a haircut, and then hopefully they like the haircut, and then therefore the reaction or the way they've received it is good as well. So yeah, I've been cutting hair for probably 5 years now, and it's, yeah, I've obviously had a barbershop back in Australia and just sort of parted ways with that recently. So a lot of the reason to get rid of the shop was just to really focus on the football side of things over here, just to clear my mind and make sure it's all my energy is going into one thing. But yeah, being able to do it just as a fun little project on the side and keeping doors open in that sense in my life. But it's a transferable skill that you can do anywhere around the world. So that was partly one of the reasons why I got into it. It's a great way to connect to people. You never know, but I think everyone's hair is going to grow for a while. So there's always going to be haircuts in my eyes. Yeah.
So far this season, the Rainbow Warriors have maintained a winning record, in no small part because of the team's foreign kicker and punter. Looking at the numbers, Matsuzawa is one of the best kickers at the college level this season. Through six games, he has made all 16 field goals he's attempted. That's more field goals than any kicker in college football's highest division. He is a candidate for the Lou Groza Award for best placed kicker in the country. I asked Matsuzawa and Gowers how they are feeling about the season so far and some of the challenges of being special teams players.
We're always talking about focusing on doing our job, whatever happens in the game. And every time we encourage each other and help each other, especially like Billy's experience and knowledge as a professional NFL player helps me to have, you know, healthy mindset during the game.
Yeah, the stats are sort of stats. They sort of tell the story a bit, but there's a lot of work that goes into it. So, yeah, it's nice to sort of get recognition for the work that we're putting in, but obviously we're only halfway through the season. We're having a bye right now, but our minds and our bodies are still fully pretty set on the job. As Kante sort of alluded on, the mindset is probably the biggest one, especially for us specialists. It's a very sort of, I wouldn't say a lonely place, but it could be very isolating when there's so much pressure on you to perform. But yeah, as Kante said, we just focus on what we can control. And
yeah, maybe talk about that, the loneliness. And I understand it's like one play out of every 10 or 20, you know, depending on how things are going, but it does put a spotlight, and I know there's a lot of pressure because a lot of things, it seems routine for people, but you know, when things go wrong, it does get magnified. So how do you mentally prepare for those sorts of things?
We always working on like mental thing, mindset. Coach Sheffield, Coach Carr, specialist assistant coach, they have like amazing mindset. And I also have a personal sports psychologist. I do this like twice a week during the season, and that also helps me. And you know, as a specialist, we need to boost confidence at any point. And you know, that's not coming from, you know, one day thing. So we're building the confidence and, you know, like healthy mindset to perform well on weekends.
Yeah, I'm quite similar to Kante. I think the coaches say it all the time. Every one of the players or athletes who's at the school is highly talented, and they're there for a reason. But what really separates the good from the really good is probably between the ears, I guess, the mental side of the game. So I do quite a bit of stuff with a sports psychologist back in Australia, and I do, yeah, a lot of sort of mindfulness, mental work. But we also do a hell of a lot of training, physical training, but we also do a lot of mental training whilst we're out on the field. So when there's times that we've got to be conscious of our bodies and how much force we're putting through our legs, just with kicking and doing our routines and stuff. But whether we do it with a ball or whether we do it without a ball, it sort of we sort of feel like we get the same results. I think there's there's evidence that shows that your brain doesn't know what's real and what isn't. So if you can imagine it, and if you can think about it, so that visualization is one thing that I know Kanse definitely does a lot of as well as I do. So yeah, it's cool.
You mentioned back home, and I know an ocean away for both of you. So how's the reception of you folks playing here back home with friends and family, and I mean just the public in general?
It's amazing. You know, without my family's support, I couldn't play last 2 years. You know, I walked on University of Hawaii, and just, you know, my family sacrificed a lot for me. And I always appreciate the support. And now, is for this year, all the efforts and showing up on the field. It's just hard to, you know, live by myself sometimes, you know, can't see my family often. But still, like, only like 8 hours flight, and they can visit to my game. So it's pretty awesome.
Have they come to a game?
Yeah, my first three games, my parents was there, and they'll come back pretty soon. Yeah,
the support back home in Australia is it's pretty profound. Of just, I suppose social media is an incredible thing these days, as well as our mobiles. So being able to FaceTime and talk to people on the phone is really cool. I was literally saying to Kanse last night that I feel like I have been back to Australia quite a bit, even though I haven't. So I haven't actually, since arriving in Hawaii in July, I haven't been back, but I feel like I'm not missing home, which is a really good sign that what we're doing here is really good. The support's been amazing.
What do you folks see for your future football-wise?
Yeah, since I started football, like, my dream is always want to go to NFL. That's the reason why I started football. It's kind of like backwards. I want to be an NFL player, so that's why I started kicking. Obviously, after the season, I want to go to NFL. But the only thing we can do right now is focus on, like, every single day and kicking, you know, one time. Like, I'm always telling myself, I make this field goal. And the goal is making every single field goal, like, this year. So, and if I can do that, like, there's a lot of chance to go to NFL.
Yeah, similar to Kanse, my goal is definitely to play in the NFL and hopefully have a long career. But, you know, there's baby steps on the way to there. So you've got to be able to, first of all, get to the NFL. And before that, you've even got to perform really well at college level. And before that, you've just got to understand the game. So, yeah, working backwards is probably one thing that both Kanse and I do a lot of. And, yeah, if we can, it'd be pretty cool if we could both get there. But there's a lot of work to get done.
We've been hearing from University of Hawaii football players Billy Gowers and Kanse Matsuzawa. They were talking with HPR's Jason Ubai. The Rainbow Warriors take on Utah State tomorrow. Kickoff is at 6 p.m. Well, that does it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we have special programming in place for the holiday, but we will be back on Tuesday. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. That's 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on the conversation page of our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR Digital team. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello, theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us next week. Pick up the conversation.